The Moccasin Ranch, A Story of Dakota. March. Early in the gray and red dawn of a March morning in 1883, two wagons moved slowly out of Boomtown, the two-year-old giant of the plains. As the teams drew past the last house, the strangeness of the scene appealed irresistibly to the newly arrived immigrants. The town lay behind them on the level, treeless plain like a handful of blocks pitched upon a russet robe. Its houses were mainly shanties of pine, one story in height, while here and there actual tents gleamed in the half-light with infinite suggestion of America's restless pioneers. The wind blew fresh and chill from the west. The sun rose swiftly, and the thin scarf of morning cloud melted away, leaving an illimitable sweep of sky arching an almost equally majestic plain. There was a poignant charm in the air, a smell of freshly uncovered sod, a width and splendor in the view which exalted the movers beyond words. The prairie was ridged here and there with ice, and the swales were full of posh and water. Geese were slowly winging their way against the wind, and ducks were sitting here and there on the ice-rimmed ponds. The sod was burned black and bare, and so firm with frost that the wagon chuckled noisily as it passed over it. The whistle of the driver called afar, startling the ducks from their all-night resting places. One of the teams drew a load of material for a house, together with a few household utensils. The driver, a thin-faced, blue-eyed man of 30, walked beside his horses. His eyes were full of wonder, but he walked in silence. The second wagon was piled high with boxes and barrels of groceries and hardware, and was driven by a handsome young fellow with a large brown mustache. His name was Bailey, and he seemed to be pointing the way for his companion, whom he called Burke. As the sun rose, a kind of transformation scene took place. The whole level land lifted at the horizon till the team seemed crawling forever at bottom of an enormous bowl. Mystical forms came into view, grotesquely elongated, unrecognizable. Hills 20, 30 miles away rose like apparitions, astonishingly magnified. Willows became elms, a settler's shanty rose like a shot tower, towns hitherto unseen swam and palpitated in the yellow flood of light like shaken banners low hung on unseen flagstaffs. Burke marched with uplifted face. He was like one suddenly wakened in a new world, where nothing was familiar. Not a tree or shrub was in sight. Not a mark of plow or harrow, everything was wild, and to him mystical and glorious. His eyes were like those of a man who sees a world at its birth. Hour after hour they moved across the swelling land. Hour after hour, while the yellow sun rolled up the slope, putting to flight the morning shapes on the horizon, striking the plain into level prose again, and warming the air into genial March. Hour after hour the horses toiled until the last cabin fell away to the east, like a sail at sea, till the road faded into a trail almost imperceptible on the firm sod. And so at last they came to the land of the straddlebug, the squatter's watchdog, three boards nailed together, like a stack of army muskets, to mark a claim. Burke resembled a man taking his first sea voyage. His eyes searched the plain restlessly, and his brain dreamed. Bailey, an old settler, of 2 years' experience, whistled and sang and shouted lustily to his tired beasts. It drew toward noon. Bailey's clear voice shouted back, "When we reach that swell we'll see the Western Coteau." The Western Coteau. To Burke, the man from Illinois, this was like discovering a new range of mountains. "There they rise," Bailey called, a little later. Burke looked away to the west. Low down on the horizon lay a long, blue bank, hardly more substantial than a line of cloud. "How far off are they?" he asked, in awe. "About 25 miles. Our claims are just about in line with that gap." Bailey pointed with his whip. "And about 12 miles from here. We're on the unsurveyed land now." Burke experienced a thrill of exaltation as he looked around him. In the distance, other carriages were crawling like beetles. A couple of shanties, newly built on a nearby ridge, glittered like gold in the sun, and the piles of yellow lumber in the straddlebugs increased in number as they left the surveyed land and emerged into the finer tract which lay as yet unmapped. At noon they stopped and fed their animals, eating their own food on the ground beside their wagons. While they rested, Bailey kept his eyes on their backward trail, watching for his partner, Rivers. "It's about time Jim showed up," he said, once again. Burke seemed anxious. "They won't get off the track, will they?" Bailey laughed at his innocence. "Jim Rivers has located about 75 claims out here this spring. I guess he won't lose his bearings. I'm afraid Blanche'll get nervous." "Oh, Jim will take care of her. She won't be lonesome, either. He's a great favorite with the women, always gassin'. Well, this won't feed the baby," he ended, leaping to his feet. They were about to start on when a swift team came into sight. The carriage was a platform spring wagon, with a man and woman in the front seat, and in the rear a couple of alert young fellows sat holding rifles in their hands and eyeing the plane for game.
"Hello,"
said the driver, in a pleasant shout. "How you getting on?"
"Pretty well," replied Bailey.
"Should say you were. I didn't know but we'd failed to overhaul you." Burke went up to the wagon.
"Well, Blanche, what do you think of it, far as you've got?"
"Not very much," replied his wife, candidly. She was a handsome woman, but looked tired and a little cross, at the moment. "I guess I'll get out and ride with you," she added.
"Why, no.
What for?" asked Rivers, hastily. "Why not go right along out to the store with us?"
"Why, yes, that's the thing to do, Blanche.
We'll be along soon," said Burke. "Stay where you are." She sat down again, as if ashamed to give her reason for not going on with these strange men. "I was just in the middle of a story, too," added Rivers, humorously. "Well, so long." And, cracking his whip, he started on.
"We'll have supper ready when you arrive," he shouted back.
Burke could not forget the look in his wife's eyes. She was right. It would have been pleasanter if she had stayed with him. They had been married several years, but his love for her had not grown less. Perhaps for the reason that she dominated him. She was a fine, powerful girl, while he was a plain man, slightly stooping, with thin face and prominent larynx. She had brought a little property to him, which was unusual enough to give her a sense of importance in all business transactions of the firm. She had consented to the sale of their farm in Illinois with great reluctance, and, as Burke rode along on his load of furniture, he recalled it all very vividly, and it made him anxious to know her impression of his claim. As he took her position for a moment, he got a sudden sense of the loneliness and rawness of this new land which he had not felt before. The woman's point of view was so different from that of the adventurous man. Twice they were forced to partly unload in order to cross ravines where the frost had fallen out, and it was growing dark as they rose over the low swell, from which they could see a dim, red star, which Burke guessed to be the shanty light, even before Bailey called, exultantly. "There she blows." The wind had grown chill and moist, the quacking ducks were thickening on the pools, and strange noises came from ghostly swells and hidden creeks. The tired horses moved forward with soundless feet upon the sod, which had softened during the day. They quickened their steps when they saw the lantern shine from the pole before the building. The light of the lamp, and the sight of Blanche standing in the doorway of the cabin at the back of the storeroom, was a beautiful sight to Burke. Set over against the wet, dark prairie, with its boundless sweep of unknown soil, the shanty seemed a radiant palace. "Supper's all ready, Willard," called Blanche, and the tired man's heart leapt with joy to hear the tender, familiar cadence of her voice. It was her happy voice, and when she used it men were her slaves. Bailey came out with one of the land seekers. "Go into supper, boys, we'll take care of the teams," was his hearty command. The tired freighters gladly did as they were bid, and, scooping up some water from a nearby hollow on the sod, hurriedly washed their faces and sat down to a supper of chopped potatoes, bacon and eggs, and tea, which Blanche placed steaming hot upon the table, in such joy as only the weary worker knows. Mrs. Burke was in high spirits. The novelty of the trip, the rude shanty, with its litter of shavings, and its boxes for chairs, the bundles of hay for beds, gave her something like the same pleasure a picnic might have done. It appealed to the primeval in her. She forgot her homesickness and her vague regrets, and her smiles filled her husband with content. Rivers and the others soon came in, and after supper there was a great deal of energetic talk. The young land seekers were garrulous with delight over their claims, which they proudly exalted above the stumps and stones of the farms back home. "Why, it took three generations of my folks to clear off 40 acres of land," said one of them. "They just wore themselves out on it. I told Hank he could have it, and I'd go west and see if there wasn't some land out there which wouldn't take a man's lifetime to grub out and smooth down. And I've found it." Rivers had plainly won the friendship of Mrs. Burke, for they were having a jolly time together over by the table, where he was helping to wash the dishes. He had laughing, brown eyes, and a pleasant voice, and was one of the most popular of the lawyers and land agents in Boomtown. There was a boyish quality in him which kept him giving and taking jocular remarks. Bailey sometimes said, Rivers would shine up to a 70-year-old Sioux squaw if she was the only woman handy, but he don't mean anything by it, it's just his way. He's one of the best-hearted fellers that ever lived. Others took a less favorable view of the land agent, and refused to trust him.
Bailey assumed command. "Now, fellers," he said, "we'll vamoose the ranch while Mrs. Burke turns in." He opened the way to the storeroom, and the men filed out, all but Burke, who remained to put up the calico curtain with which his wife had planned to shield her bed. Blanche was a little disturbed at the prospect of sleeping behind such a thin barrier. "Oh, it's no worse than the sleeping car," her husband argued. A little later he stuck his head in at the storeroom door. "All ready, Bailey." Bailey was to sleep on the rickety lounge, which served as bedstead and chair, and the other men were to make down as best they could in the grocery. Bailey went out to the front of the shanty to look at the lantern he had set up on a scantling. Rivers followed him. "Going to leave that up there all night?"
"Yes.
May keep some poor devil from wandering around all night on the prairie," Rivers said, with an abrupt change in his voice. "Mrs. Burke is a hummer, isn't she? How'd his flat-chested nibs manage to secure a queen like that? I must get married, Bailey, no use." Bailey took his friend's declaration more lightly than it deserved. He laughed. "Wish you would, Jim, and relieve me of the cookin'." Blanche could hardly compose herself to sleep. "Isn't it wonderful?" she whispered. "It's all so strange, like being out of the world, some way." Burke heard the ducks quacking down in the moccasin, and he, too, felt the silence and immensity of the plain outside. It was enormous, incredible in its wildness. "I believe we're going to like it out here, Blanche," he said. Blanche Burke rose to a beautiful and busy day. The breakfast which she cooked in the early dawn was savory, and Rivers, who helped her by bringing water and building the fire, was full of life and humor. He seemed to have no other business than to wait and tend on her. He called her out to see the sunrise. "Isn't this great?" he called, exultantly. Flights of geese were passing, and the noise of ducks came to them from every direction. He pointed out the distant hills, and called her attention to a solemn row of sandhill cranes down by the swale, causing her to see the wonder and beauty of this new world. "You're going to like it out here," he said, with conviction. "It is a glorious climate, and you'll soon have more neighbors than you want." After breakfast, Bailey and Burke left the moccasin ranch as Bailey called the store and shanty, to carry the lumber and furniture belonging to Burke onto his claim, 2 or 3 miles away. Rivers remained to work in the store, and to meet some other land seekers, and Mrs. Burke agreed to stay and get dinner for them all. During this long forenoon, Rivers exerted himself to prevent her from being lonely. He was busy about the store, but he found time to keep her fire going and to bring water and to tell her of his bachelor life with Bailey. She had never had anything like this swift and smiling service, and she felt very grateful to him. He encouraged her to make some pies and to prepare a thumping dinner. "It will seem like being married again," he said, with a chuckle. Burke and Bailey returned at noon to dinner. "Mrs. Burke, you can sleep on your own ranch tonight," announced Bailey. "I guess it will be a ranch. It'll be new, anyhow," her husband said, with a timid smile. After dinner she straightened things up a little, and as she got into the wagon she said, "Well, there, Mr. Rivers. You'll have to take care of things now." Rivers leered comically, sighed, and looked at his partner. "Bailey, I didn't know what we needed before, I know now. We need a woman." Bailey smiled. "Go get one. Don't ask a clumsy old farmer like me to provide a cook." "I'll get married tomorrow," said Rivers, with a droll inflection. They all laughed, and Burke clucked at the team. "Well, goodbye, boys, see you later." After leaving the ranch they struck out over the prairie where no wagon wheel but theirs had ever passed. Here were the buffalo trails, deep worn ruts all running from northwest to southeast. Here lay the white bones of elk in shining crates, ghastly on the fire black and sod. Beside the shallow pools, buffalo horns, in testimony of the tragic past, lay scattered thickly. Everywhere could be seen the signs of the swarming herds of bison which once swept to and fro from north to south over the plain, also silent and empty now. A few antelope scurried away out of the path, and a wolf sitting on a height gravely watched the teams as if marveling at their coming. The wind